We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28, and to donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, June 30th, and big week at the U.S. Supreme Court. A number of decisions were released yesterday at 10 a.m. and shortly following that we're going to discuss this morning. And then we are still waiting for a couple of very big decisions, including what is set to be a landmark case on birthright citizenship. So that is expected today around 10 a.m. Eastern time. Meanwhile, President Trump took to social media yesterday to react to the Supreme Court's decision in several cases, some of which he decried and others he celebrated. This coming from Apple News. The nation's highest court announced several rulings on Monday, including one regarding late arriving mail-in ballots and the other dealing with presidential authority to fire independent regulators. And so we're talking first about the presidential authority on independent regulators. So the justices yesterday issued decisions in two cases related to presidential authority to oust certain federal officials. They ruled that Trump can fire many independent regulators, but at the same time said this decision didn't extend to the Federal Reserve, affirming the agency's independence and stating that its officials couldn't be fired at will. So to discuss all of this and more, let's welcome in Mike Donnelly, who's an attorney and professor. And Mike, let's talk about these two decisions, because Trump kind of largely celebrated this, calling it a big win and saying it confirms that presidential power in our country to remove executive branch officers and agency appointees or representatives. The decision was long sought by United States presidents. And so it's an honor in his term to be the sitting president who won this historic and unprecedented ruling. What do you think about this outcome?
Well, it's the right outcome, Jenna. The court got this one right. And when you look at Trump v. Slaughter, which is the case for independent commissions, okay, so you've got these independent commissions, Federal Trade Commission, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. You got a dozen or more of these quote-unquote independent commissions, which Congress created for various purposes. And where this case comes from is it's back in the 30s, I think, 20s, 30s, where the court said, with respect to the Federal Trade Commission, that it only exercises judicial and legislative authority, but not executive authority. And therefore, the court said you can't remove people unless it's for cause. And this was the Humphreys executor case that people have been referring to. And the court has been circumscribing that case for almost a century, and now it's dead. The court explicitly overruled Humphrey's executor, saying, look, Congress can delegate a lot of stuff to the president. And when it does so, it's the president's call. And Congress cannot put restrictions on who the president gets to work with. And so the president gets to hire and fire those whom he wants to. If it's part of the executive branch, it's under the president's authority. And that's the way our Constitution is structured. We have separate branches of government: executive, judicial, and legislative. And although I think that Congress has delegated way too much power, and the Supreme Court has allowed it to do so, I completely disagree with that. But if it's going to do that, the president has to be able to run the executive branch, because who got 77 million votes in this country? You know, it was the president of the United States. And that means that we, the people, are putting him in charge. and he needs to be able to hold people accountable to pursue his policies. And if they don't, then he should be able to fire them at will. And that's what the court said.
Yeah, and that absolutely makes sense for the executive branch, particularly when you have so many presidential appointees, that even if these are for appointments that would extend past the term of a president, he should be able to fire them, or another incoming president should be able to fire them, just like, you know, if a CEO of a corporation were to hire someone that outlasted his term as CEO, the next CEO that comes in should be able to run the corporation as he sees fit, because he was hired to do that job. And so what is the competing view? I mean, why it took so long for Humphrey's executor to even be overturned? I mean, this seems like a very simple proposition when you're talking about the executive branch.
Well, it is, except the administrative state likes to protect its turf, and it's been able to do so politically over the years by having justices on the court who protected them. You know, it wasn't long ago that a 6-3 conservative court, so-called conservative, you know, was a 5-4 liberal court, with, even though you had five Republican appointed justices. You know, Justice Kennedy caused us a lot of problems. At any rate, I believe that's what the answer is. And it just took time for the court to get around to doing this. You know, the court moves at a slower pace, and sometimes it takes a while for it to correct itself. I mean, it took us, what, 50 years to get rid of Roe v. Wade. And even then, did we solve the problem? No, we just kicked it to the states. But at least, you know, we recognize that the federal government is divesting itself of power, which is a great thing. It has too much power. It needs to divest itself of power. And the Supreme Court seems to be moving in that direction. And I think that's overall a good thing for the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And to move at a little bit more nimble of a pace. But you also mentioned, you know, this whole problem with the rise of the administrative state. And that's, you know, solely on Congress. I mean, for creating a lot of these agencies that up until now have been very insulated from accountability, because Congress isn't really holding them accountable. And then if the executive doesn't have the power to fire, you know, some of these individuals, unless it's, you know, really extraordinary circumstances, like, for example, when Congress, since its creation of the Federal Trade Commission, Congress has held that commissioners can only be fired for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance. I mean, that's a pretty high standard. And so to have more accountability in these agencies is a good thing. But I think the more foundational question is, why is Congress creating so many agencies, delegating its power, and we have this rise of the administrative state that's essentially insulated from the electorate and the will of the people? Because ultimately, the people should be the ones that get to determine, you know, who are in all of these offices, like we can with our elected representatives, our elected president. But with a lot of these bureaucrats, they're insulated from true accountability to we the people. And that goes back to Congress delegating a lot of their authority. And the Supreme Court doesn't seem that interested in correcting that issue.
Well, it's true. And I want to point out there's a difference between Federal Reserve and federal commissions. People may be wondering, well, if he can fire commissioners, why can't he fire a Federal Reserve chief? And the court in Trump v. Cook basically held that there's a history and tradition of independent banking in the United States of America. And it goes back even to before the Constitution. Congress explicitly put in the Federal Reserve clause about pause firing. And I also want people to realize that both of these cases came up on stays, meaning the district court had stayed or the appeals court refused to stay a district court's injunction against firing these people. And so they are parallel in a sense. In the case of Slaughter, which overruled Humphrey's executor, the court said, no, we're going to let the president fire these people. In the case of Cook and the Federal Reserve, they didn't say he can't. The challenge was that she didn't get any due process. Trump just fired her without any reason, and the statute requires some due process, and so is the Fifth Amendment of the federal constitution. And so the court basically said, look, you can't just fire her for no reason. You've got to go back, and she's at least got to have due process. So this is going back, and I think at the end of the day, Cook is going to get fired for cause, potentially, because she was alleged to have committed mortgage fraud. And so if you're a federal bank regulator and you're committing mortgage fraud, That's a problem. I think Trump is going to prevail, but he can't just do it for no reason.
Interesting. Yeah, and that's a really important distinction. And, you know, often when in some of these cases, when you go back and you have the process, it wasn't, especially when we're talking about Trump's executive actions, a lot of times we've ended up seeing ourselves in the same situation where he ultimately gets the outcome he wants. It's just that the process needed to be followed more precisely or particularly. And so I agree with that assessment. What about, you know, this whole question of congressional non-delegation, because that's been a doctrine in jurisprudence, you know, for a really long time, stemming from the Constitution, that, you know, Congress and the executive, I mean, they can't just delegate their authority to other branches, because then otherwise the separation of powers collapses on itself. But it seems like this kind of fourth estate, not just talking about media, but the rise of the administrative state, has gotten so much delegation of congressional authority that is very much outside of constitutional parameters.
Well, that's true. And that's because the Supreme Court allowed Congress to get away with passing laws that have to do with the general welfare of the country under the spending clause, which it should never have done. Congress should only be allowed to spend money on things that are specifically enumerated in the Constitution. But the court has allowed it to get away with it, and therefore has essentially removed any real constraint on Congress's authority outside of the Constitution. And so what Congress has done is set up all these different agencies, and then the court had to come up with the doctrine you referred to, which is the non-delegation doctrine, which means that there are certain things that Congress can't delegate away, and guess who gets to decide what those are? The Supreme Court of the United States. So, you know, the fox is guarding the hen house, basically. You know, I say that because, in my view, the federal government, even though they fight amongst the different branches, the president fights with the Supreme Court and Congress, and they all fight amongst each other, at the end of the day, they're all about protecting their own federal power at the expense of the states and the people. And so, you know, and that's what the court has said. Okay, Congress, you know, we'll decide what you can delegate away, and it pretty much allows them to delegate anything until there's something that they don't like them delegating. And so it's a confusing doctrine, and what the court needs to do is just go back to saying, look, if it's not in the Constitution, you don't get to delegate any of it, period, because it's reserved to the people and to the states for the 10th Amendment.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if we actually followed the parameters and the limits in the Constitution. I mean, how much better off we would all be if Congress could only spend on things that are actually enumerated in Article 1. I mean, then there would be no real reason to, you know, have the 16th Amendment and have, you know, this outrageous income tax that's virtually you know, just limitless, and having Congress spend all kinds of money on things that DOGE uncovered a lot of it. And yet we saw that even among Republicans in Congress, how, to your point, Mike, they're just protecting their own power. They really didn't want to take away all of their spending. They don't want to balance the budget. And that's the problem with the federal government, is that they won't restrain themselves. Even the people who describe themselves in the Republican Party as fiscal conservatives, when it comes down to it, they really aren't. And at least the majority of even Republicans are not truly fiscal conservatives. And, you know, that's been going on for decades. I mean, you know, that was part of Barry Goldwater's argument all the way back in 1984, the year I was born. He was talking about how Republicans are wanting to spend too much of other people's money, and that's something that is, you know, so far outside of the parameters of what conservatives should be advocating for. So in just the last minute we have, you know, what's the solution then to say, okay, if the Supreme Court isn't going to rein them in, Congress isn't going to rein themselves in, what's the solution?
You gave me 1 minute to answer that question. Okay. Repeal the people of the United States need to repeal the 16th and 17th Amendment. We need to stop giving the federal government taxing authority over, you know, our pockets, taking money from us whenever they want, however much they want. And we need to put the states back in control of, well, not control, but at least have a seat at the table where they're represented as states. Right now, the 17th Amendment took that away in 1913. So get rid of 16 and 17, and I think we'll be on the path to recovery.
All right. See, I knew you could do it. That was even under a minute. So thank you so much, Mike Donnelly. You can find him on X at Donnelly Speaks. I'd encourage you to follow that. Give some great analysis of the Supreme Court opinions and a lot of other things in politics you should be paying attention to. So we'll be right back with more to talk about the other Supreme Court case that was very important from yesterday. We'll be right back.
America's 250th birthday. It's a great excuse to have some extra cake and ice cream, but we can help your celebration go well beyond that. Show your patriotism with America 250 apparel that will become a memento of this special year. We also have special episodes on AFA Stream to help underscore that America is a Christian nation and help you find God in the Constitution. Find all of this and more in one place. afa.net/topics/250. Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, yesterday in a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court ruled that federal law does not require mail-in ballots to be received by Election Day, holding that states may count ballots postmarked by Election Day but received afterward if state law allows it. Unfortunately, Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote to the majority opinion. There's been a lot of expressed disappointment for her appointment across social media and commentary. And Justice Alito responded to the ruling saying, quote, "I cannot support this irresponsible escapade." So for more, let's welcome in Hans von Spakovsky, who is a senior legal fellow at Advancing American Freedom. And Hans, break this down, because this just seems so dumb, quite frankly, from the Supreme Court, that now instead of protecting Election Day, they have now basically protected election, you know, weeks, months, and some of this nonsense that's going on in California.
Well, unfortunately, I agree. It was a 5-4 decision, and you had the Chief Justice joining Amy Coney Barrett in a very bad opinion, along with the three liberal justices. What's really struck me, Jenna, about reading this opinion is you go from what Amy Coney Barrett writes with the other four justices, and then you go to Justice Alito's opinion. Justice Alito wrote the dissent, joined by the other conservative justices, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and it's so clear that Alito knows so much more about election laws in this country, our historical practice of how we've been conducting elections, and Amy Coney Barrett comes across as an amateur, frankly, in comparison to him, and the logic in her opinion just to me just doesn't make sense. In particular, you know, her whole case is based on the idea that Election Day only applies to the electorate making their choice. Well, you and I know that's not true. You can, for example, with an absentee ballot, you can fill it out in your home, but until you actually deliver it to election officials, the ballot is worthless, right? I mean, the vote's not going to count. And she just seems to completely miss that, whereas Alito gets that exactly right.
Well, and this is a really frustrating kind of ideological grouping and lineup with, as you mentioned, Barrett and Roberts joining the three liberal justices, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. And we can understand why the three liberals would want to expand Election Day as long as they can. But, you know, Amy Coney Barrett is not, you know, an idiot by any means. I mean, she's a justice on the Supreme Court. She used to be a law professor. I mean, all of these things. I don't understand the logic at all in this decision and why it wouldn't have very easily been a 6-3 opinion here. I mean, and Justice Roberts, the same thing. I mean, especially with all of the issues surrounding election integrity that you know, as you've long said, election integrity has been an issue in the background for decades. But of course, it reached a lot of attention with the 2020 election and beyond, that this wouldn't have clearly been a 6-3 opinion.
Look, I completely agree with you, but as you know, particularly when it comes to Chief Justice Roberts, most of the time he is a conservative and he can issue great decisions like the one in which, students prepare admissions versus Harvard, where they finally got rid of and said you can't discriminate on the basis of race in college admissions. But there are times when he crosses over to the liberal side and issues just terrible decisions that as a conservative who believes in the Constitution and the rule of law, you just can't understand. And obviously, you know, the worst example of that was when he joined the liberals to say that Obamacare was constitutional. Mm-hmm. And I can't explain it other than he just makes bad decisions. And this is a case where Amy Coney Barrett joined him in making a decision that all the rest of us are sitting there going, how could you decide this? You're clearly wrong, as Alito said, on historical practices, prior precedents, and the statutes themselves. About the only saving grace in this, Jenna, is the fact that Barrett did make it clear they were simply interpreting the three federal statutes that set Election Day. They were not looking at any constitutional issues. What that means is that Congress could change those federal statutes. And in fact, as you and I both know, there's currently a bill stuck in the Senate, the SAVE Act, that would in fact change this issue, change federal law and say mail-in or absentee ballots have to be in the hands of election officials by the end of Election Day.
Yeah, and this goes back to a principle that we've talked about ad nauseum on this show, that Congress actually needs to act. I mean, we're going to have that same conversation tomorrow when we talk about the birthright citizenship case and what we all anticipate is likely to not be a very good decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. Right. I mean, we'll see. That's supposed to be out today. But ultimately, Congress needs to act. And the same thing here, that Congress needs to act. And instead, they're just basically going along with, well, this is what the Supreme Court said, so, you know, we'll go along with it. Why doesn't Congress want to govern?
Well, you know, part of the reason is because at the most, you know, members of the U.S. Senate work 2 days a week, and then the rest of the time they're off. And the kind of old-fashioned Senate that we all imagine, where people are actually on the floor debating and fighting, just isn't the norm anymore. I mean, there's a few people there who are willing to fight for stuff like this, Mike Lee being a prominent example, who's been one of the biggest people trying to push through the SAVE Act. But unfortunately, we have a small number of Republican senators who aren't, well, so-called Republican senators, who aren't willing to get the SAVE Act approved and through the Senate.
Well, and so, Hans, does this decision ultimately, I mean, how far back does this set the overall election integrity effort? And, you know, beyond, of course, pushing Congress to act, where do we kind of writ large go from here?
Well, if the SAVE Act can't get through Congress and fix this bad decision, the only alternative to that is in the states. And yes, we can't get this fixed in blue states, but red state legislatures, and remember, most of them will be starting up, Jenna, in January, state legislatures ought to pass their own versions of the SAVE Act. Remember, this whole case came out of Mississippi. Mississippi allows 5 days for absentee ballots to come in after Election Day. Why does the state legislature allow that? It's a Republican-controlled state. They need to change their law and fix this themselves, and they ought to pass their own state version of the SAVE Act to require, for example, proof of citizenship when people register to vote. Now, they can only apply that to state elections. They can't apply to federal elections because some bad prior Supreme Court precedent, which the SAVE Act is trying to fix, but that would be a partial remedy to the problem.
And how many states currently allow ballots to arrive after Election Day and so would be affected by this ruling?
Well, the last count that I did, it was 30 states.
Wow, which is just absurd. I mean, and this just goes back to public confidence because, you know, Election Day
yes.
should mean a day, right? And I think when all of us are looking at the difference, for example, of how Florida has cleaned up elections and especially, you know, under Governor DeSantis's leadership, and we actually, you know, find out who won same day, like shocker, right? And then we look at the contrast between other states, including and especially California, that just keep receiving ballots. And it seems like to the public, I mean, there's a lot of sentiment that it's like, okay, they just keep counting ballots until they decide that, you know, okay, we're going to call it here because we like who wins. I mean, that's the public perception. And so public confidence is really low in elections. And that's very unfortunate because not only can it suppress the turnout, it can reduce confidence and in our leadership and our government. I mean, it has a lot of different ramifications. But the Supreme Court, unfortunately, didn't really seem too concerned about that. And that's somewhat surprising to me, especially after all the controversy surrounding 2020.
Well, no, you're exactly right. But in fact, it was of concern to Alito and his fellow dissenters. In fact, he says that in the dissent, that this decision will not increase public confidence in the integrity of the election process. He understands that it's clear that Amy Coney Barrett and Chief Justice Roberts don't understand that.
Yeah, and it's so frustrating, I think, to people who simply want this to be a nonpartisan issue. I mean, election integrity should not be an issue where Democrats are pushing for something and, you know, and Republicans are pushing for something else. I think overall, those who are pushing for the SAVE Act, for some of these other things, are just pushing for election integrity across the board because the same rules should apply to everyone. We should make sure that the people who are actually casting ballots in elections are actual qualified voters. I mean, that seems to be a very reasonable thing. And yet this has become so partisan and so divisive, really unnecessarily. And it just goes to show that, you know, the Democrats are interested in something else besides election integrity. And so as we move forward with this issue, I mean, I don't think this issue is going away anytime soon. And hopefully red states will cure some of these issues and potentially Congress might. How big of an issue do you think this is and should be for the upcoming midterms as well? Because if we can't get things through the Senate, I mean, then it's just stalling. And that's where we're at with the Save America Act. And a lot of the Republican base should be concerned about that. Yet, you know, we're hearing that this might be, you know, kind of a neck and neck and whether or not President Trump and the GOP will prevail after midterms.
I think that in the same way that President Trump, as you know, in his first campaign made a big deal about who was going to be on the Supreme Court, and the American people really paid attention to that, I think they need to make a big deal about this. Why? Because polls overwhelmingly show that Americans think you should not only have to show an ID to vote, but that you should provide proof of citizenship so that you are actually an eligible citizen to vote. And the fact that Democrats are against this, I think, calls into question their basic view of integrity. In fact, it makes them look like they want to be able to cheat. And I think Republicans ought to make a big deal about that because that support for ID goes across party lines. The Democratic leadership is not in line with their constituency, The majority of Democrats support both of those. And I think that is a wedge issue that Republicans can successfully use against Democrats.
Yeah, and they should. I mean, especially as the Democrats are going so much further to the left. I mean, you have all of these socialists that are now invading their party. I mean, these are people that, you know, shouldn't be holding office anyway. But it goes back to all of this goes back to election integrity. It goes back to ensuring that only American citizens can vote. And so where then should we focus beyond the state legislatures in terms of some of the legal challenges? What are some areas that we can still press on election integrity?
Well, I recently wrote a paper on the fact that there's currently a split in the federal appeals courts. You know, this sounds procedural, but it's not. Remember, the National Voter Registration Act has a very specific provision giving the public access to voter registration records and the efforts or non-efforts states make to keep those records clean. You know, in other words, what do states do to make sure, for example, that aliens aren't registering to vote? And unfortunately, there are a number of federal appeals courts that have said, well, no, the public really doesn't have access to those records. And states don't have to provide those records. And that's an issue that the Supreme Court needs to take up because transparency in that area is very, very important. And there are a number of cases working their way towards the Supreme Court on this issue. That access to voter registration records across the country is vital to cleaning up our system.
Mm-hmm. That is so important, and it should be. I mean, just like, you know, you have to re-register, you know, your car every 1 or 2 years, you know, you have to re-register a lot of different things. Why can't we have across the board, you know, some kind of accountability where maybe every presidential year you have to go back and even just show that you're still, even if you're an American citizen, they have to show that you're still a resident of the same state. I mean, you know, in Colorado, my former home state, I still get a mail-in ballot, you know, at my former address. Right. I mean, it's ridiculous that the voter rolls haven't been purged. And that happens, you know, all the time with mail-in ballot states. I mean, there are so many different issues. But Hans von Spakovsky, I'm really grateful for all of the work that you do and everyone at Advancing American Freedom to continue to press on election integrity. This issue should not go by the wayside. Yes, Trump won a resounding victory in 2024, but that doesn't mean that we let the issues of election integrity just kind of fall by the wayside. We should still champion this, ensure that only citizens are voting in elections and only people who actually can vote are voting, and also that we ensure that the process is ultimately transparent and fair and correct. So, I mean, again, this shouldn't be a partisan issue, but really appreciate it, Hans, and we will be right back with more. It's been 4 years since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, but tragically, abortions have continued to rise. Today, the abortion pill accounts for more than 60% of all abortions, and last year alone, over 1.1 million babies lost their lives. That's why the work of Preborn Network Clinics is more urgent than ever. Every day, mothers facing unplanned pregnancies walk through Preborn's doors searching for hope. Instead of pressure and fear, they're met with love. Through a free ultrasound, mothers meet their baby for the very first time.
It was like the beginning of my healing journey. They do an ultrasound, and that's when everything changed. Because when I saw my baby, and when I heard her heartbeat, that was it.
Just $28 sponsors one ultrasound. $140 helps rescue 5 babies. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome Welcome back. Well, the Supreme Court yesterday also ruled 6-3 that the federal courts cannot review the Department of Homeland Security's decisions to terminate temporary protected status, or TPS. So the decision clears the way for the Trump administration to end protections for approximately 350,000 Haitian and Syrian nationals. This is a very good thing. This is what DHS Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen said on TPS ending yesterday. This is cut three.
They don't have an option now. The courts ruled they have to go back. They don't have to go back to the country they went to. They can go. They can choose another country, and we'll assist you in that. You can self-deport, or we're going to pick you up. What I was saying on Jake Tapper is, like, people have been here 15, 20 years. They had time to change their status if they wanted to. Because you didn't change your status, there's nothing I can do at this point. The court has spoken. Full stop. Period. There's no other place to go to change your status now. You're going to have to go back to your country you came from and change your status, or and what I mean by change your status, reapply to be able to come into the country legally, because as of right now, TPS is ended and you're currently in the country illegally. So I'll give you a $2,600 check and an airline ticket to go back to the country you choose that will accept you, or go back to your country.
All right. Well, Mark Wayne Mullen came under fire a little bit for some of those comments and suggesting that, you know, he'll give a check to these TPS recipients to just get on a plane and go back to their country, or be arrested and deported. As you said, these are the two options that you have. But my view is, why even give them money? Just tell them, you know, get your own plane ticket and go. Otherwise, we'll arrest you and we'll the federal government will send you. And that's how they should be spending their money. But let's welcome in a Representative Marlon Stutzman from the great state of Indiana. So your thoughts overall on this Supreme Court decision? I think it's a very good thing. And do you think that DHS is correct, at least in their posture of at least encouraging these TPS recipients who now don't have protections and are basically holdovers to go back to and basically self-deport?
Yes. Good morning, Jenna. Great to be with you. Yeah. No, I'm actually very happy with the Supreme Court. And, you know, first of all, I'll just say this, that, again, this shows why the Biden administration really put a lot of these people in a very vulnerable position by misusing the law. You know, again, it's easy to blame, well, the Trump administration's being mean here, or, you know, that the Trump administration's doing this or that. Well, actually, they shouldn't have been here to begin with in some cases. And if they would have come through the proper process, maybe as refugees or other status, then maybe things would have changed. So I think the Supreme Court did the right thing. They upheld the law. I think this really points back to, again, the Biden immigration policy being so misused and abused that a lot of people are the ones that are paying the price for it today.
Yeah. And, you know, this really goes back to the Trump administration's priorities that Trump ran on in 2024, and a lot of Republicans did, saying that we need to not only close the border now, but we need to have mass deportations. And this is part of it. I mean, some of these people who may have come in under, you know, some kind of protected status, temporary is supposed to mean temporary, and it shouldn't be a loophole toward asylum and toward permanent status. And so do you think that we are ultimately going to see more deportations through DHS because of this decision?
Well, very possibly. And again, you know, that's one thing that the Democrat Party has been doing a very good job is fighting for illegals in this country more than they fight for the American people. And, you know, there's roughly 10 million illegals that came over during the Biden administration. I mean, think about that. I mean, you know, 10 million people in 4 years, that's cities. I mean, large, large cities that immigrated illegally into the United States over a 4 year period of time. Before that, at the end of 2020, there's an estimated 10 million illegals in the country from, you know, years gone by. And so I think that that, again, just shows you the magnitude of the situation and the problem that we have. That there are at least 10 million that came across the border. We have no idea who they are, where they're from, what they're up to. And I think that that's what the Trump administration has, you know, why he won again in 2024 is because he told the American people, I'm going to put a stop to this. You know, he started building the wall in his first administration. I went down to the border in 2024 and saw some of the Biden border that was supposed to be put up. It was embarrassing. It was laughable because people would still be able to run down to the end and come around the corner, jump a couple of concrete barriers and tear up their IDs and come across the border. And so it was, you know, Joe Biden just created a magnet for illegals to come in. But I do think that President Trump and the administration are going to keep doing what they told the American people they would do. And I think that also Mark Wayne Mullen is just the right person to handle this job. He's going to follow the law. He's going to enforce the law. He's going to use common sense. And I think he's been doing a fantastic job so far.
And speaking of, you know, of Congress trying to support the Trump administration's priorities and the American people's priorities on mass deportations, closing the border and all of that, we are set to likely receive the birthright citizenship case from the Supreme Court later today in just a few hours. And most people are anticipating that that's not going to be a good decision overall for conservatives and overall for America, with the Supreme Court not putting a stop to some of these citizenship attempts by, you know, foreign nationals and basically invaders that are coming here and having children that then become American citizens just through the virtue of simply being present in the United States. And Congressman Brandon Gill has stated, you know, multiple times, I think is an excellent advocate on this issue, that citizenship shouldn't be given to children of illegals or people that are just, you know, here for the purpose of taking advantage of the system. Is Congress going to support the Trump administration's view on this issue if we do receive the opinion we're anticipating?
Well, that's a great question. I do think that Republicans will, Democrats won't. This has been the issue, and I think that's why Democrats are where they're at as a party today, electing socialist, Marxist, communist. They're fighting for the illegal. And I agree with Brandon that, you know, the intent of our founding fathers, it was a very different world back then. You know, transportation wasn't quite the way that it is today. And of course, leaving an open border, allowing for people to come across to have a baby so that's American citizen. I think that clause has been so abused. And my hope is that there's some common sense on the court looking at intent, but I'm probably more with you where I don't know that it's going to be a decision that we like, but that's why Congress needs to act. And we need to clarify that, you know, if you are born of two illegals in this country, you're still an illegal. You're not here properly. And the fact is there's proper ways to do it if they would follow the laws you know, leave the country and come back through the proper channels. I've always believed in a high wall and a wide gate, but that gate needs to be controlled, or the gate needs to be managed, and people need to come to the country legally. So the federal government has failed 20 million people by letting them come in illegally. Now, some of them maybe have overstayed visas and other issues. Each case can be different, but in mass, you know, the Democrat Party has been wanting mass, you know, illegal immigration into the United States because they think it's going to help them somehow politically. Now, so far it is in the sense that they are being counted in our census, and then we use those census numbers to draw the House of Representative maps across the country. And so I actually just signed on to a bill that Andrew Glide proposed that illegals cannot be counted for apportionment for districts. And so California likely has two, maybe three, if there are 20 million illegals in the country, they may have three, maybe four districts that they should not even have compared to other states like Indiana, where we aren't a sanctuary state like California is, or like Minnesota or New York. So that's why this issue really does matter. It's going to be a fight in Congress. I hope Republicans stick together on it, and maybe we'll even get a couple of Democrats. We'll see.
Yeah, I hope it's a fight in Congress and it's not just a fight on, you know, media and having select Republicans say, you know, like yourself and Brandon Gill and a few others saying, you know, we need to do this. But overall, that fight doesn't actually happen in Congress, and not even just with illegals. I mean, absolutely, I fully applaud everything that you've said, but also even with birther tourism and, you know, people who are coming. I mean, we've seen the numbers from China that, you know, they're sending their nationals to basically have children here so that then they can control American citizens. I mean, this is a really big issue. So hopefully we'll have that fight in Congress. But I want to turn to another topic in the last minutes I have with you, Congressman Stutzman. You were on a call where Marco Rubio and Steve Witkoff briefed Congress on the Iran peace talks. And so top deputies of President Trump briefed Congress on Iran peace talks in a conference call yesterday. This was the first time administration officials have addressed a broad group of lawmakers since Trump signed that memorandum of understanding. What did you learn on that call?
Yeah, no, it was a great call. And of course, President Trump and the Marco Rubio and Steve Witkoff and the vice president have all been working so hard for so many different reasons. And again, I think what this shows is that President Trump is not a forever war president. He is not one to send in a bunch of, I mean, there's no troops in Iran compared to what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. We went in, we bombed from the air, we sent rockets and missiles in from the ships in the Middle East, and we have set back the IRGC dramatically. Now, I like to separate the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, from the Iranian people, because the messages that we're hearing from the Iranian people is that they want freedom. They want the IRGC gone. This is a group of thugs and dictators and religious zealots that took over Iran back in 1979. And we've been dealing with them for over 40 years, right at 50 years. And so they've said, look, we are dealing with people who move the goalposts. They lie, cheat, steal. But we are going to continue to put the pressure on economically, and we're going to put the pressure on militarily to bring these guys to the table. Now, do I think that they will maintain and keep the promises that they make in the MOU? Likely not. But that's why, you know, our motto should be untrust but verify. And we can follow through with making sure Iran is weak, that they are not able to get a nuclear weapon, that they can't control and limit the travel through the Strait of Hormuz. So Marco Rubio is doing a fantastic job of being sure. The one thing that I want to clarify, and I think most people need to understand, that this MOU, it's like a letter of intent. It sets the parameters. This is not a treaty. And the Democrats and the mainstream media like to say, oh, we're going to give them $300 billion. That's not what the MOU says. It mentions $300 million in the context that if you do certain metrics, if you meet certain criteria, then there will be funds. But those funds are not coming from taxpayers here in the United States. They would come from other parts of the Middle East or from sanction relief and other pieces that can be spelled out. So this is not taxpayer dollars. This is a much better deal than what Barack Obama made with the Iranians to keep them from having a nuclear weapon. President Trump is a strong negotiator and a strong diplomat, and he's going to use the full strength of the economic power of the United States and the military.
So it sounds like you were, pretty confident in President Trump even going into the call and then after this briefing. And so, you know, we're coming up on the November midterms, and there's a lot of, you know, concern around the ongoing conflict, gas prices, you know, that kind of thing. Do you think that with this letter of intent and then pushing toward the fuller agreement, even though we don't really think, you know, Iran is going to follow a lot of it, do you think that this conflict will be sufficiently concluded before the November midterms, at least to the extent that the public has confidence in the economic and perhaps other effects?
Well, I think, Jenna, that there's so many good things going on in the economy. I mean, just being home over the weekend, over Father's Day, the restaurants were, the parking lots were packed in northern Indiana. I was talking to woodworking companies, and they're up 30%. The economy is really strong in my neck of the woods. Gas prices are an issue, but I also hear from older people that we need to finish the job, especially. I think what President Trump is doing is the right thing. He's giving the IRGC a chance to, I mean, the Ayatollah's dead. They have complete disruption of their leadership apparatus. There might be somebody new there that is going to use a little more of a level head and say, hey, I want to live rather than die. You never know in those groups of bad people. They, you know, there's no honor amongst thieves. And so there might be somebody there who says, let's try to take the country a direction that is better for themselves. There's always self-interest, of course. But I think that President Trump is saying, look, we bombed the tar out of you guys. We can keep doing this, or you guys can come to your senses and try to find some sort of pathway towards peace. Do I think it's a long-lasting peace? I doubt it. But at the same time, I think it's worth the try to try to be able to define a path forward, and let's see what where their weak spots are. And if they fail, we've got a strong military in the wings.
Yeah, well, and President Trump isn't afraid to use that, and I think that's ultimately a good thing. Congressman Stutzman, thanks so much. You can follow him at Rep. Stutzman across social media. I'd encourage you to do that. And we'll see what the Supreme Court says today in the coming hours on birthright citizenship. I have coverage of all of that tomorrow morning. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net. Preborn has rescued over 400,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com/AFR.